When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, this week I'm talking to Paul Burston, author and host of the queer literary salon Polari.
I actually had sex with somebody once waiting for a night bus in Trafalgar Square. Yeah.
You're listening to Probably True. Please be aware that this podcast may contain strong language and adult themes. It would be boring without them.
Well, it was 1988, so I would have been 22, I think. I'd finished university and I devoted myself basically to being a full-time scene queen. And I was having a lot of fun, a great lot of fun. There wasn't really a lot of drugs around, that I was not that I was aware of anyway. People would go out and just get drunk on beer or steal beer. In my case, sometimes I'd have somebody, I've got that pint over there.
Wow.
So, yeah, there wasn't that kind of like glass-fronted, we're happy to be seen. It was all quite sort of behind dark windows. And yeah, it was like ultraviolet lights everywhere. And you could see everyone's dandruff on their shoulders. Yeah. And there was a big video screen, which in those days was a novelty to have a video screen in a bar. And you could pay money to choose videos, which of course, you know, you didn't have control of videos in those days to watch pop whenever you wanted to. And I remember they used to always have Don't Leave Me This Way by Bronzy B. That was always on. Whenever you went into Harpoon Louise, that was on. And there was I Want to Dance with Somebody by Whitney Houston. That they take me back to that place. There were different sort of tribes within that as well. So, you know, you had that kind of Frankie Goes to Hollywood look, which that was pretty much Saturday Night at Heaven, that was. That was the kind of men-only night at heaven, which I actually came out by going to heaven. That's how I came out. I didn't tell anybody. I just went to heaven on my own and stood outside. So I knew there was this gay club called Heaven because everyone knew that. And I'd seen something in Time Out magazine, I think it was. And I went along and stood outside. I had this spiked up hair, like sort of trying to look like Ian McCulloch from Echo and the Bunnymen. I had plucked eyebrows and makeup and I think two earrings in each ear. And I may have had a nose stud as well. And I stood outside for about 2 hours watching these men queuing up, and none of whom looked at all like me. They all looked like village people and lumberjack shirts and moustaches. And I just couldn't go in. So I stood outside chain smoking and I just went back to Waterloo, got the train back to Richmond and university again. But I went back the next Saturday and the next Saturday. And then eventually in the third week, I actually plucked up the courage to go in.
Getting a little bit closer every time. Yeah.
And I went down those hallowed stairs and I remember the sense of this smell, which I didn't recognise it was because it was poppers. I didn't know what it was, just like old socks, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And you walk into this room and the first thing I heard was this guy sort of swished by saying, "So many men, so little time," which were the lyrics to a popular dance tune of the time. And I just turned and ran out again because it terrified me. And then the following week I went back and I stood literally with my back against the wall. Didn't talk to anybody, just stood against the wall, looking at people. I was 19. I was so terrified. And then eventually someone talked to me, and then that one thing led to another.
With that particular someone or just generally?
With that particular someone, yeah. He broke my heart, though, of course.
Bastard.
Yeah, bastard. It was one way to do it. Come out. Wasn't the best way, probably. go to a big, huge nightclub on your own and be terrified.
It puts me in mind of learning to swim. You start off just your feet in the water, then you've got your floaties on and yes, you're kind of bobbing about, and then you start moving around.
I've always tended to jump into things too much, so I can't just go to my local gay bar in Richmond. I have to go to the biggest gay club in the whole world at the time, probably.
Well, if you're going to do it properly.
Yeah, just throw myself into that. Yeah, I had many, many, many great times there. Many great times there.
Good.
Over the subsequent years.
And were there so many men and so little time?
Well, there were, yes, definitely, in both senses, because we didn't realise then just how many men were going to have so little time.
No.
And it all changed very, very quickly. It became quite prophetic, really. I was making up for lost time. I had fun. I made lots of new friends.
Sure. Even if you didn't quite know their names.
Yeah. Well, I always knew their names, at least while we were together. I'm quite choosy like that.
You're a classier bitch than me.
Yeah. I actually had sex with somebody once waiting for a night bus in Trafalgar Square. Yeah. Actually in the queue for the night bus.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
Like in the queue.
Yeah. By the National Gallery.
Was no one else in the queue tempted to join in? Or offer some kind of...
But waiting for the night bus in Trafalgar Square in those days was a real hotbed of activity. Everyone would come from Heaven or Soho in the middle of the week, and there'd just be so many gay guys queuing for the night bus in Trafalgar Square. Honestly, so many people I know from that period have got similar stories of just like getting on the different night bus because you fancied somebody and suddenly find out you're in East London and you live in Richmond or vice versa, just because there was a hottie on the bus.
Aww.
Yeah.
And hoping that they'd give you somewhere to stay for the night.
They usually did, out of charity. For me, part of the fun of that period of my life was that you'd go out and you'd meet people and you'd meet people that you wouldn't normally meet. You'd meet a cross-section of people. I had friends all different ages, all different backgrounds and sexualities and genders. And I think it became much more fragmented later. And I think that the success, it became a victim of its own success in a way, because there wasn't the connections. After AIDS happened, because that was a huge thing in my life when I was about 25, 26, most of my gay male friends at that point were some years older than me, because I wanted someone to sort of be my older brother and teach me and show me the ropes and stuff. Mm. And they were the ones that all died. So I lost all of them pretty much. And then I became an AIDS activist and got really involved in all of that. And for all of the things that I would not change for anything, well, you know, there were a lot of things about the 80s I would never want to have back. But there was a sense of community, and people did pull together, and they did rally, and there was communication between different generations and different tribes within our communities. And nowadays, I'm not sure if that's true anymore. I think that there was a break in the chain because there was a generation that was kind of lost to HIV and AIDS. There was the generation that were impacted by it, like my generation, who went through an awful lot of grief in a very short space of time, which was very traumatic. And I'm probably not really over it yet, to be honest. It's probably still in there to some degree. Mm. And then it becomes a very difficult subject to talk about, so you don't talk about it very often. And then the younger kids are coming along, and they don't know how half of this stuff even happens. They never know their history half the time when you talk to young people. They have no idea what was going on 10, 15 years before they were. Because why would you?
No.
You know, I didn't when I was that young either. I think I must have been about 22 when I first heard about it. My boyfriend at the time read something in one of the gay papers and said, oh, we have to start using condoms. And I was like, what? And then I'd heard that someone I was at college with who was a mature student, and he disappeared for a long period. He didn't come back after this term. I then learned on the grapevine that he was gay, that he had this boyfriend who was American. They basically both contracted HIV, and he died really, really rapidly. I wasn't friends with him, really. I didn't know him. I just knew him to say hi to, really. And he was the first person, that was the first person that I knew of. And then the guy I was living in the tower block with, who I was very close to, and was a real mentor of mine, I moved out and I went to see him one night, and he was odd. Something was odd about it. The whole evening was very strange and strained. And I remember asking him, well, how he just said, seeing somebody recently, this new boyfriend. And I said, how are things going with the boyfriend? And he said, well, it's a bit difficult because, you know, he's upset because, you know, I don't want to have sex now that I'm HIV positive. And that was how he told me. And I just had to put this brave face on and just get through this conversation. I was absolutely shocked and devastated because back then that meant a death sentence. There was no treatment. And I remember sort of sitting through this dinner feeling absolutely awful and then getting home on the train and just crying the whole journey home. And he became really ill really quickly. And then one of his dying wishes was he wanted to go to Amsterdam. He'd never been to Amsterdam. And his friends, most of them were straight women, elected me to be the person to take him. And I took him to Amsterdam on this trip, and I spent the whole time thinking he was going to die on me. And how was I going to manage to get him? What would I do? I was 24 years of age, 25 years of age. It was horrendous. It was very frightening. When he was in hospital, I used to go and visit him, and I'd be helping with things. And I remember one time picking up this urine bottle off the bed and tipping it on myself and being paranoid. Even though I knew deep down that this was not something that was going to pose any risk to me, we didn't really know. People didn't really know much. There wasn't much information. And this is before Lady Diana went into the AIDS ward, and this is before all this sort of stuff happened. It was still a period where it was not really spoken about. If it was, it was spoken about in hushed voices. And it was a very frightening time. And he was a very, very good community-minded person. He was involved in the running of the building, and everyone knew who he was. He would chair meetings and whatever. And then after he got ill, someone daubed on his front door, House of AIDS, on his front door. Fucking hell. And then he died, and I was really in the state about it. And I read in one of the papers there was a meeting happening at the London Lesbian Gay Centre in Cowcross Street in Farringdon, which is no longer there, but it was a very popular place back then. And there was a meeting happening. It was ACT UP. And I knew what ACT UP was already happening in America, so I knew what ACT UP was. So I went along to this meeting. I just threw myself into it. And it took over my life completely for like 3 years. And it was a way of sort of channeling the grief, because over those 3 years, it was just one funeral after another. It was just... You got to the point where you'd actually dread answering the phone. And I used to have Filofax then, because everyone had a Filofax back in the 80s. And I remember every year just like taking all the names out, taking the different people out, because people would just die all the time. Even my family, I mean, I love them to bits, but they just did not understand why this was any different to my grandfather dying. It's like, because that's expected, because he's fucking 80 and he smokes and he's ill. And these men shouldn't be dying in their late 20s, and early 30s. It's completely mad. It was like there was a war going on, but only we knew about it. It was like the wider world was completely oblivious. And yet within our world, which was a very, very contained gay London world, there was a war going on and people were dying all around us. And we were expected to carry on as normal. Well, how the fuck do you do that? How the fuck do you carry on as normal when people are dying? There's no way to stop it, and you might be next. Because there's always that anxiety you're going to be next. So there was a long time where I didn't get tested for ages. I was terrified. I didn't want to be told that I had it at that time. What was the point? You're going to die. So I avoided it until there was a treatment available. It was a very frightening time. One felt very isolated and suddenly very aware of your own mortality at an age when you shouldn't be. Suddenly being 25 and suddenly dealing with death on a massive scale is shocking. It's like being in a war. It's all I can compare it to, really. But out of it, there came some good stuff, because it made us very visible, not in a very good way necessarily, but it made us very visible. It galvanised people, because you were literally fighting for your life. So what the fuck did you have to lose? ACT UP was a very, very empowering thing to do for me and for the people involved, many of whom were people with HIV or AIDS, or people who were like me who had friends who were ill or died. And it was a way of channeling all of that grief and doing something constructive with it and feeling like you were making a difference by raising awareness and also having great fun, because there's a great buzz about being a direct action activist, you know, storming buildings and blocking traffic and scaling walls of prisons and throwing condoms over them and things like that. I mean, there were lots of great buzzes. There's a buzz to do that, you know. The meetings weren't such a buzz. They were quite boring and long, but the actual actions were great. And I wasn't afraid of arrest or anything, so I didn't really have anything to lose. I didn't have a proper career, so I wasn't worried about losing a job or anything. I just worked casual work. Other people involved in ACT UP couldn't do that because they had jobs that they had to protect, but I was happy to do it. So I was in the action committee, so I was getting arrested all the time. I mean, I literally had... And back then, of course, there was no communication between police divisions. So if you got arrested, say, in Trafalgar Square, and you got taken to Bow Street Court and given a bind-over to keep the peace, blah, 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 you could then go off and get arrested in a different area of London and get another bindover, because they wouldn't know you already had one. So at one point I had about 6 bindovers. It was almost like a badge of honour how many bindovers you had at one point, you know. Just
put them on the fridge. Yeah.
It was cool.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss. There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Looking back on it now, because with the benefit of hindsight and you know, having read more and learnt more, you realise how precious that time was, because you know, you had sort of the Stonewall riots in 69 and you had like the 70s. And then by the end of the 70s, it was like bam, because AIDS hit in 81 in America. So you literally had a decade of gay freedom, and then you had bam, and all went really, really like shocking. You never would imagine that. On the back of that, we had several setbacks. Because then you had the fact that AIDS had happened, and the way the press was reporting it, you know, was that we were all swirling in a cesspit of our own making, was one of the phrases that was used. And so there was an awful lot of right-wing hysteria and backlash against anything to do with gay positive rights or images. Section 28 happened, which was the first anti-gay legislation to be introduced in like hundreds of years. I think people have this naive belief, and I certainly had it, that progress just happens automatically. It just slowly things get better. I'm not sure that's actually true. I think things go in circles and sometimes things swing back the other way. And that was a real wake-up call. You know, AIDS and then Section 28 was just such a huge wake-up call. I don't see how you can live through that and not be politicised by it. I can't see how on earth you would live through it. So I became a very political animal. And anyone who wasn't basically got bored of listening to me rant on about it. So I stopped seeing those people. They stopped inviting me for dinner parties, you know. Paul's great family. He's a bit of a bore at the moment. He just bangs on about bloody ACT UP. So I didn't see people apart from people within that world. And I spent lots of time with people that were living and breathing ACT UP all the time. I did get burnt out in the end, because you do get burnt out, because you can't do that for very long. It's very consuming. And I had a very good friend that I met through ACT UP called Spud, who I loved so dearly. And then he died. And then I just when he died, I couldn't face it anymore. I had to leave then. I was like, no, I can't do this without him there. It's too much for me. So, yeah.
Were there moments when you thought, why bother? Were there any kind of hopeless moments?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the thing as well is that, you know, ACT UP was not universally loved by the gay community. We were not seen as being diplomatic. There's always been that thing between the good gays and the bad gays. So you've got the Stonewall group doing all the kind of lobbying and being nice and talking to politicians. And you've got Outrage and Peter Tatchell causing a ruck. We were in that camp, obviously.
And Professor X versus Magneto.
Yes, exactly. And there was a lot of hostility to us. And when you're sort of putting your whole life into something and then you're constantly being discredited and slagged off in the press, as we were repeatedly, it did make you feel like giving up. I remember one particular meeting that there'd been rumours that ACT UP had been taken over by far left entryists or something, which wasn't true at all. But certain people wanted to believe that as a way of discrediting us. And there was this long meeting at the centre on a Friday night. It went on for hours and the press were there. And I remember one gay journalist from one of the papers, which remained nameless, making this big speech, just tearing us to pieces. And I was like, oh, for fuck's sake, I'm done here. I can't. Why are we doing this? Why are we doing this? And just being so upset. And then I used to write for a paper called Capital Gay, and the proprietor, Michael Mason, was there. I went crying to him after the meeting in the bar upstairs. And I was like, I'm giving up. I'm just leaving. I can't do this anymore. And he said to me, just go home and think about it. And I'm really glad he said that, because I was going to just resign. Not the one who had a formal position at ACT UP. You just turned up and just threw yourself in and left. But, you know, I was going to announce, I was very dramatic. I'm going to announce my resignation. I can't do this anymore. Yeah, I was going to flounce off. And I didn't. And I'm glad I didn't. But yeah, there were times when you'd think, why are we doing this? Often during the meetings, actually, because sometimes the meetings would go on very long and people would be sort of debating the finer points of this and the finer points of that and bickering and falling out over the choice of a word or the wrong word or this word or that word. And it became like, this is not what we're here for. You know, I remember this one meeting where people were arguing. We had an action that weekend. People were spending so many hours when we should have been getting the placards and everything ready. And so me and a few guys just started doing it in the middle of the meeting, just got down on the floor and started painting placards while everyone else was rowing. Just get on with it. I mean, our slogan was Action Equals Life, which was a kind of the inverse of ACT UP New York, which was Silence Equals Death. We felt that was too nihilistic, I suppose. So Action Equals Life was our motto. And I still believe that. I still think if you're feeling down about something, do something. If your writing isn't going well, go for a walk. You know, yeah. Action does literally equal life. It does literally make you feel much better. So being an activist did give me a sort of life force that wasn't there otherwise. But there were times when it was hard to hang on to that, definitely, yeah. I feel like I was very young. I was very young for my age because I was very naive and very inexperienced in lots of ways. And I had quite a sort of rapid growing up, which was when AIDS happened. I grew up very quickly in a very short space of time. And I think the thing that I learned was that it sounds pat, but it's so true, which is that, you know, you never know how long you've got. You never know. You could get knocked down by a bus tomorrow. I could get a brain tumor tomorrow. You never know what's going to happen to you. And I just think if you have dreams and ambitions, try and do something with them. I meet people all the time who say to me, I've always wanted to write a novel. Well, write it then. It's not going to write itself. You have to write it. And, but it's really hard. Yes, it is hard. That's where all writers will tell you it's hard. Every writer I know, when they're about two-thirds of the novel, they hate everything that they've written. And it's the worst novel ever been written. It's never going to get published. That's called a first draft, and you'll fix it later on. Just don't keep putting things off because it's not going to be perfect. Don't wait until all the circumstances are right, because they may never be right. Just do the best you can do now, but do it now. Live in the moment and make the most of the moment, and don't let it just become the past. There's so many things I wish I'd done when I was younger. So many things I wish I'd done, and I tried to make up for as I got older. I think you regret the things you didn't do more than the things that you did do. That's certainly been my experience. And if there are things that you have ambitions or dreams, then do something about it. Just do something. You know, try. And if you fail, fine. But try again. Fail again. Fail better next time. And eventually you'll get there. But don't just use fear of failure to stop you from even trying. So many people in life do that, and they end up doing things that they hate doing. And then they wake up when they're 55 or 60 thinking, what on earth have I wasted my life on? I've pretty much done what I want to do most of my life in terms of work. And it isn't easy. And sometimes it's difficult to make ends meet. And sometimes you need support from other people. And sometimes you wish you had more money to do more things. But you're doing what you love doing. And I don't think there's anything more rewarding than that, really. My first ever gay flatmate was what we now call a yuppie in those days. Very nice guy. Worked for a television company. Had a huge fuck-off salary. Big, flashy car. Hated his job. Absolutely hated his job. And he would just live for the weekend when he could go out and get absolutely trolleyed to get away from his work. And I know people who live like that now. And I couldn't live like that. If it means that you can't afford to do all the things you'd like to do, well, sometimes that's worth it. Sometimes you need to find a balance where what's good for you as a person is more important than having 5 holidays a year or whatever it might be that you spend money on. Choosing my career path will not necessarily bring you fame and fortune. But if you're doing something that you love, and I think most creative people understand that, you know, if you're a creative person, you understand that you just have to do it. If you don't do it, you feel out of sorts. You know, if I have a week where I don't write anything, I get really, really unhappy. It really affects my mental health. I feel really low, and I have to do it. So make the time and treat it seriously. Give it the time that it needs. And if that means you need to fit it in around another job, then fine, do that. We've all done that. But make time to do the thing that you love, because no one's going to do it for you. You just have to do it. You have to do it yourself, and you have to give it enough respect and treat it with enough value and decide for yourself that it's worth doing. What an awful waste to go through life and not having done the thing that you were probably sent here to do. You were probably born to do. And it may be that changes. My husband was a ballet dancer for most of his life. And if you know anything about ballet dancers, that is a real vocation. They spend their entire time training and in class and everything and rehearsing, often for very little reward. And also their career is over when they're 40. So he's now got a second career as a Pilates teacher, and he's doing really well, and he's fantastic at it. And he's now found another vocation. So I'm not saying that the vocation I'm talking about would be the same one all your life, but at whatever stage you're at in your life, if there's something that you're dying to do, just do it. Really, do it. Don't sit there and look back when you're 60 and wish you had. It's like such a sad waste.
Have you considered a future career as a motivational speaker? I would pay to sit and listen to you talk like this. It's lovely.
If you want to know more about Paul, his books, and the literary salon Polari, there's plenty of information online.
Twitter is just at Paul Burston. They can find out about Polari by going to our website, which is www.polarisalon.com. Well, I've got a new novel just come out, which is called The Closer I Get, which is about, it's a psychological thriller, and it's about a gay novelist with writer's block and an online admirer woman who he meets at a book signing. And it's about the relationship between them. Nothing is quite as it seems. So it's ostensibly about a man being stalked by somebody, but there's a bit more to it than that.
And that's it for this week. If you need me, I'll be at the bus stop. No reason. That was Probably True, the multi-award-winning storytelling series written and produced by me, the multi-award-winning Scott Fleshart. It was designed to remind all of my queer siblings that we are none of us alone. You can find links, transcripts of every episode, and all that good stuff at probablytruepodcast.com. If you enjoyed or found value in anything you've heard today, you can support the show on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/probablytrue. And if you want to get in touch, just search Probably True Podcast on the socials. And now it's time for some Patreon compliments. First up is Dr. Brinley Pearlstone, who is just as exciting and charismatic as you'd expect for someone whose name sounds like it's come straight out of an Indiana Jones film. The second compliment this week goes to Peter the Enigmatic, who didn't give a surname, as he enjoys the air of mystique that comes with keeping people guessing. As always, you can get your very own Patreon compliment and support the show in the process by going to patreon.com/probablytrue.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.